From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It's a sad event that African Union forces have been attacked, but this confirms our view that the African forces cannot provide protection to themselves, let alone the people of Darfur.
Over 1,000 armed rebels storm an African Union base in Darfur, killing at least 12 peacekeepers in the worst attack on the international force since they were deployed in 2004. We'll speak with the acclaimed Sudanese human rights lawyer and opposition member of the Sudanese parliament, Saleh Mahmoud Asman. Then Kenyan environmentalist and Nobel Peace laureate, Wangari Maathai, on wars over resources, her Green Belt movement, and climate change.
And I would wish, and especially with respect to climate change, that America would provide the leadership that is needed, and that she would not be the one falling behind, because her attitude towards climate change and towards what we can do to mitigate the impact, the negative impact of climate change, especially in Africa, is very important.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh is reporting there's been a significant increase in the tempo of planning for war with Iran inside the Bush administration. Writing in The New Yorker, Hersh reports the White House recently requested the Joint Chiefs of Staff redraw longstanding plans for a possible attack. Hersh also reports the Bush administration's rationale for bombing Iran has shifted from Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program to Iran's role in Iraq. Hersh writes, quote, "What had been presented primarily as a counter-proliferation mission has been reconceived as counterterrorism. The focus is no longer a broad bombing attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, but strikes on Revolutionary Guard Corps facilities in Tehran and elsewhere." On Sunday, John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, called for the U.S. to attack Iran and for the overthrow of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. During a meeting in England, Bolton said negotiations with Iran had failed and that he saw no alternative to military action. In Burma, thousands of military troops have taken over downtown Rangoon as the military junta intensifies its efforts to crush a wave of pro-democracy protests. Over the weekend, Burma's military leaders locked down Buddhist monasteries, arrested dissidents, and set up barricades across the country. The Wall Street Journal reports at least 700 monks and 500 other people have been arrested. Dissident groups say they fear hundreds of protesters have been killed over the past week. The military junta is attempting to control all information coming out of the country. The government's reportedly ordered the closure of several privately owned newspapers that refuse to print government propaganda. Burma's only internet server has been shut down. The government's blocking all text and picture messaging on mobile phones. British Ambassador Mark Canning is in Rangoon and says the military has, for the moment, squeezed the protests off the streets. UN Special Envoy Ibrahim Gambari arrived in Burma on Saturday and met with jailed pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The Nobel Peace Laureate was briefly released from house arrest for the meeting. Gambari has also been holding talks with members of Burma's military junta, but he has been prevented from speaking with Burma's top military chief. Meanwhile, Japan's Congress of Journalists has condemned military junta after Burmese troops shot dead the Japanese journalist Kenji Nagai. Video footage has been aired in Japan showing Nagai was shot at point-blank range. This is Toto Yamaji, president of APF News in Japan. Kenji Nagai was 50 years old. In Sudan, at least 12 African Union peacekeepers were killed in Darfur Sunday in the worst attacks on international troops since they were deployed in 2004. The killings occurred when over 1,000 armed rebels stormed an African Union base. More than 50 other troops are reportedly missing. The attack took place just as a new diplomatic initiative for peace got underway. A delegation of so-called elders, including South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, arrived in Khartoum on Sunday. We'll have more on Sudan after headlines. In Iraq, the number of U.S. troops killed since the invasion has topped 3,800. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports more than 185,000 troops have sought medical care after being injured in the war. The total number of Iraqis killed since the U.S. invasion is unknown, but some estimates put the total at over 1 million. A military court-martial has cleared an Army sniper accused of murdering two Iraqi civilians. But the sniper specialist Jorge Sandoval was sentenced to 5 months in prison for placing detonation wire on one of the bodies to make it look as if the man was an insurgent. An Iraqi journalist was killed by a mortar shell in the northern city of Mosul Friday. Abdul Khalik Khasser is the seventh journalist to be killed in Mosul this year. Amnesty International is calling on the Shiite-led Iraqi government and U.S. forces to protect Palestinian refugees living in Iraq. Amnesty says Shia militias have committed gross human rights abuses against thousands of Palestinian refugees, including abduction, hostage-taking, unlawful killing, torture, and other ill-treatment. Blackwater has received a new $92 million contract from the Pentagon to fly passengers and cargo between locations around Central Asia. The contract was announced while Blackwater is the target of several investigations over its role in Iraq following a deadly shooting in Baghdad 2 weeks ago that left at least 11 Iraqis dead. Newsweek has obtained an extensive evidence file assembled by the Iraqi National Police after the September 16th shooting. Iraqi officials concluded Blackwater forces opened fire unprovoked from the ground and the sky. Over the weekend, the State Department revealed Blackwater employees have been involved in 56 shootings while guarding U.S. diplomats this year. Meanwhile, Blackwater has put off plans to buy 1,800 acres of farmland near Fort Bragg in North Carolina, where it was planning to set up a training ground for soldiers and corporate executives. Blackwater's founder, Eric Prince, has been called to testify before Congress on Tuesday. Syria has accused Israel of making excuses for war by spreading false reports that an alleged Israeli Air Force strike earlier this month targeted a nuclear facility. Syrian Vice President Farouk al-Sharra says Israel bombed an empty area on September 6 after Syrian air defense systems confronted the aircraft.
The Israelis are making up things to justify an aggression in the future. They are playing on public opinion to mislead it.
The Guardian newspaper reports President Bush was castigated by European diplomats on Friday and found himself isolated after a special conference on climate change ended without any progress. European ministers, diplomats, and officials attending the Washington conference criticized Bush for failing again to commit to binding action on climate change. Britain and almost all European countries want mandatory targets for reducing greenhouse emissions. President Bush is pushing for nations to voluntarily reduce emissions. Morgan's Peter Carl outlined the European Commission's vision on how to tackle the crisis.
What we have put on the table is twofold. In the first place, an offer that we are prepared to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by the year 2020, provided that other major emitters amongst the developed countries do the same. And secondly, and perhaps at least as importantly, we have made a decision, not a commitment, it's a unilateral decision, that we will, whatever comes out of the climate negotiations, reduce our CO2 emissions by 20% by 2020.
In other environmental news, the Washington Post has revealed the Environmental Protection Agency's pursuit of criminal cases against polluters has dropped off sharply since President Bush took office. The number of prosecutions, new investigations, and total convictions are all down by more than a third. Critics of the agency say its flagging efforts have emboldened polluters to flout environmental laws, threatening progress in cleaning the air, protecting wildlife, and eliminating hazardous materials. A new series of medical studies suggests the stressful effects of racism play a role in why the infant mortality rate for African-American babies is so high. Black infants are more than twice as likely to die as white or Latino babies in the United States. The infant mortality rate in some predominantly black areas, including the Mississippi Delta and Memphis, is higher than those of many third world countries. In campaign news, Republican presidential candidate Senator John McCain has suggested he only wants to see Christians elected to be president. He said, quote, "I admire the Islam. There's a lot of good principles in it, But I just have to say in all candor that since this nation was founded primarily on Christian principles, personally, I prefer someone who I know has a solid grounding in my faith. McCain's comment came during an interview with the website BeliefNet, in which he also claimed the Constitution established the United States as a Christian nation. Salon.com reports a powerful group of conservative Christian leaders decided Saturday at a private meeting in Salt Lake City to consider supporting a third-party candidate for president if a pro-choice nominee like Rudolph Giuliani wins the Republican nomination. The decision was made during a gathering of the Council for National Policy. Christian leaders involved in the decision include James Dobson of Focus on the Family, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, and former presidential candidate Gary Bauer. And in other campaign news, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich has publicly ruled a possible run for the Republican nomination out. In Costa Rica, more than 100,000 people rallied on Sunday to protest the Central American Free Trade Agreement with the United States. It was one of the largest protests ever in Costa Rica, which has a population of about 4 million people. Voters in Costa Rica head to the polls Sunday to decide whether to ratify CAFTA. Opponents say the so-called free trade deal will threaten the livelihoods of Costa Rican farmers and will limit the country's sovereignty.
We don't believe that we should sacrifice in a rough or dishonest way the social state of law which Costa Rica has enjoyed for so many years. And with this pact that they are trying to sell to other nations and in the interests of very few, that is what we are opposed to.
The governments of Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic ratified the free trade deal, but did so without holding a vote. And about 1,000 cyclists rode through the streets of San Francisco Friday to mark the 15th anniversary of the monthly ride known as Critical Mass. Since the first Critical Mass in San Francisco in 1992, the ride has spread to over 300 cities around the world. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, over 1,000 armed rebels stormed an African Union base in Darfur Sunday, killing at least 12 peacekeepers. More than 50 others are reportedly missing after the weekend raid. The precise identity of the rebel group that carried out the attack remains unknown. Since the now-defunct Darfur peace agreement was signed in May 2006, the number of rebel groups operating in Darfur has grown fivefold, from 3 to 15. Sunday's attack on the African Union base was the deadliest since the 7,000-strong force arrived in Darfur in 2003. The assault came weeks before the planned initial deployment of an expanded United Nations African Union force of 26,000 soldiers. High-level peace talks in Libya between the Sudanese government and the Darfuri rebel groups are also scheduled to take place later this month. This latest took place just as a new diplomatic initiative for peace got underway. A delegation of the so-called elders, including South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu and former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, arrived in Khartoum on Sunday. This is how Archbishop Desmond Tutu described the purpose of their visit to Sudan.
We do not represent our countries or any country or non-governmental or intergovernmental organization. We consider ourselves elders of a global village. Due to the urgency of the conflict and immense suffering in Darfur, we have decided to come here first. This is our first mission as elders.
Saleh Mahmoud Osman is an internationally recognized human rights lawyer from Darfur, an opposition member of the Sudanese parliament. He has given free legal aid to the victims of arbitrary detention, torture, and persecution by the Sudanese state for over 20 years. At the height of the violence in Darfur in 2004, Sudanese security forces arrested Osman and detained him without charge or trial for 7 months. He was released after a hunger strike and today continues to defend political and civil rights in Khartoum and Darfur. Osman received Human Rights Watch's highest award in 2005 and is one of the three finalists for the European Union's Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought this year. Saleh Mahmoud Osman joins me here in New York at the Firehose Studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the attack that just took place?
Sure. It's sad news. I must confess to that. But still, it confirms our fears that African Union forces have no capacity and they are not in a position to provide proper protection to the people of Darfur, let alone to themselves, again, first of all, let alone the people of Darfur.
Who attacked them?
I don't have the concrete news about it, information about that, but most probably now the presence of the African Union forces has been controversial since last year when so many people had the feeling that these forces are not in a position to provide protection to the people. And sometimes people say that they are siding with the government of Sudan in so many occasions because sometimes atrocities occur in front of their eyes, but they don't intervene to protect the lives of the people there.
Who shores up, who funds, who finances and the African Union, the peacekeepers?
In fact, also I don't have the concrete information, but my guess is that it is the international community, it is the UN itself that finances the presence of the African Union forces on the ground in Darfur. It's not the AU as such. The AU, the African Union, is providing soldiers, but it is the UN, other countries around the world, who provide the facility, the finance for them.
So what do you think needs to happen? Do they simply need more finances, or should it be a different force?
It should be a different force. It is the UN, AU hybrid forces that is that might possibly provide the protection that is needed. And now we have the UN Security Council Resolution 1769 that says it is the responsibility of the international community to send the robust force in Darfur to protect the lives that are perishing on a daily basis.
Can you talk about the overall situation in Darfur right now? The displaced people, are the murders, the attacks, the rapes up or down?
Sure, because the current situation is that still we have more than 2.5 million people who are being forcibly displaced from their homes, living in the camps right now, and they are held there for indefinite period. They don't know when and how they can go back to their homes. And we have also refugees across the border in the Chad Republic. They are also there for so long time now, and they are not also capable to come back to their home. And it is very sad, very, very important to mention that the land that have been depopulated by these people is now occupied by people coming from outside Sudan, Arabs coming from Niger, from Chad, from Mali, and even from Mauritania to settle. That seems to establish what we have been calling it an ethnic cleansing right now that is happening. Still, the government of Sudan is using helicopter gunships and Antonov aircraft to target the African communities. And there is always the influx of IDPs, displaced people, coming into camps.
Sully Osman, what is the significance of the elders coming to Sudan? Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the former Archbishop of South Africa, former President Jimmy Carter.
We appreciate immensely their initiative, but still, it's always doubtful if there is no collective international community will to resolve the situation in Darfur, because on one hand we have this government of Sudan, which is very much determined that the plan of ethnic cleansing or genocide should be established before the international community intervenes. On the other hand, we have the rebel groups who are now splitting among themselves and makes it very complicated that efforts of peace talks or ceasefire is always very much difficult to say. But let's see how the elders are going to make the initiative and what is their plans. I don't know exactly whether they are mediators or they are going to put pressure on the government of Sudan.
We're talking to Saleh Mahmoud Osman, internationally recognized human rights lawyer from Darfur. We'll be back with him in a minute. Omar Issas, that's Darfur Baladna, the song, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Last month, Luis Moreno Ocampo, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, urged the international community to support his efforts to arrest the two Sudanese officials wanted for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. I want to play a clip of the response from Abdel Mahmoud Abdelhalim Mohammed, the Sudanese ambassador to the United Nations.
In no way we are going to surrender any of our citizens to be prosecuted abroad. If there are any crimes, the place is Sudan, and the people to do that is the Sudanese judicial system.
Saleh Osman, your response.
My response is that everybody knows that our Sudanese judicial system is incompetent and unwilling to provide justice to the victims. It is because we don't have in our penal code provision that makes it a crime like crimes against humanity or war crimes, let alone genocide. But the ambassador knows that up to this moment, even inside Sudan, notorious perpetrators who are highly implicated in the commission of crimes, there are still beyond the reach of our domestic justice. So there's no possibility of any perpetrator being held accountable for his acts in Sudan. It is only the International Criminal Court that has the jurisdiction to bring to justice those who are still enjoying privilege, like Haroon, who is now State Minister for Humanitarian Affairs. And lastly, he has been also included in a commission to investigate about violations of human rights in Darfur and elsewhere in Sudan. That is very much insulting the feelings of the victims. It is just like putting insult to grievous injury.
What about the upcoming high-level peace talks that are going to be hosted by Muammar Gaddafi, Libyan leader, between the rebel groups and the Sudanese government?
I'm not very optimistic about that, because we have seen there have been always talks from now and then in Libya, but there was no result at all. The situation is that we have the rebel groups, the old factions of the rebel groups, who don't have one single unified negotiating position that would make it very much difficult. Some are willing to go, others are not. But
what has been Gaddafi's role?
Gaddafi has been always saying he's a mediator, but so many people don't have that same feeling that he's the appropriate mediator.
Why?
Because, in fact, always Libya has been seen as somebody who has interest in that for himself. And there are some factions who are very much affiliated to Libya, and that is makes it like there is no possibility that all the factions might agree.
The role of China?
The role of China, we are very much sad to say that China is for a long time been undermining the interest of the people of Darfur. That is in the context of always the victims and survivors has this feeling that China is not doing sufficient effort to address the humanitarian situation there in Darfur.
Is the relationship with Sudan that China has based on oil?
It is based on oil and other economic interests. And that is why China is always siding with the government of Sudan. But nevertheless, we have seen some improvement in the position of China when the last United Nations Security Council Resolution 1769 was adopted. China was also there. China was not abstaining. China joined other members of the Security
Council.
Saleh
Osman, you were detained in 2004 for 7 months. Are you concerned about returning to your region of Sudan, Darfur, where you live?
Yes. I'm determined to go back, and I always go back there. And I go to the camps even inside Darfur, elsewhere, everywhere, around Niala, Al-Fasha, Zalinji, and Al-Jineina. So there's nowhere that I can avoid standing with the people there in the time of their suffering. This is an immense human suffering there that is going on in Darfur.
I want to thank you very much for stopping by our Firehouse studio here in New York. Saleh Mohammed Osman, internationally recognized human rights lawyer from Darfur. As we turn now to our second subject of the day, the environment. President Bush convened a special meeting on climate change over the weekend. The move came just days after he skipped a major UN summit on the subject. The meeting in Washington, D.C. was sponsored by the Bush administration and brought together 17 of the world's leading polluters. On Friday, the president outlined his vision of dealing with global warming on an individual and voluntary basis.
Our guiding principle is clear. We must lead the world to produce fewer greenhouse gas emissions, and we must do it in a way that does not undermine economic growth or prevent nations from delivering greater prosperity for their people. Each nation will design its own separate strategies for making progress toward achieving this long-term goal. These strategies will reflect each country's different energy resources, different stages of development, and different economic needs.
But the Bush administration's voluntary approach to tackling global warming received little support. The U.S. position was isolated as European, Chinese, and Indian diplomats all questioned Bush's leadership on climate change. Even as the Bush administration continued to reject mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions, other countries called for more binding measures. Last week, I spoke to a woman who's been on the front lines of the popular struggle for the environment long before the current global warming crisis. She began fighting state-backed deforestation in the 70s by spearheading a grassroots movement to plant and care for trees. Now she's calling on people around the world to plant 1 billion trees in the next year and get involved in the fight against climate change. Her lifelong activism recognized in 2004 when she became the first environmentalist to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm talking about Kenyan ecologist and founder of the Greenbelt movement, Wangari Maathai. She was in the United States to mark the publication of her memoir. It's called Unbowed, tells the story of Maathai's journey from rural Kenya to the international stage. Wangari Maathai was in Seattle when I spoke to her from our Studio B. I began by asking her to describe the impact of global warming on Africa.
Well, global warming will impact Africa very seriously. We are already beginning to see some signs, such as the disappearance of ice and snow on Mount Kenya and Mount Kilimanjaro, the drying up of some rivers, and prolonged droughts that cause a lot of havoc, especially to pastoral communities who keep livestock. Also, receding of water in many lakes, especially in the Great Rift Valley. Now, I want to hasten to add that there is a very thin line between what may be caused by deforestation, devegetation, and general misuse of the environment, and of course, the impact of global warming. But in long term, the impact of global warming will be only enhancing these initial signs that we see in Africa.
What is the Green Belt Movement?
Well, the Green Belt Movement is a grassroots organization that focuses on planting trees and practicing primary environmental care to the land in order to ensure that the land becomes sustainable and supports livelihoods of communities. So it is not only an organization that takes action, but it's also an organization that teaches, that empowers, that raises awareness on the need for each individual to work with nature, to work with the environment, and to help the environment sustain the current livelihood, and of course, to support the livelihood of the generations to come. So we work largely with women, we also work with men, but we are also very focused on children.
The Green Belt Movement is very closely identified with women. Why in particular women?
Well, when one reads the book that I'm partly here to promote, Unbound, you would see that the initial idea came to me as we were preparing to go to Mexico in 1975 to the first United Nations Conference on Women. Also in East Africa, it is the women who actually work on the land. They fetch firewood, they fetch water. So women are very close to the primary natural resources. And in the mid-70s, there was a clear sign that there was very serious environmental degradation. And that is why the women were lacking some of these primary resources. And so we said, let us try to restore some of these resources by planting trees to protect the soil, to protect the forest, to protect waters, and especially rivers. And so the Green Belt Movement was actually inspired by rural women who were preparing to bring their problems to the world stage in Mexico.
And how large has it grown?
Well, while starting very, very small, the Green Belt Movement has expanded not only within Kenya and within Africa, but to many other parts of the world. And in a big way, it has inspired ordinary people to do something about their immediate environment by doing what is doable, what can be supported by the economic situation and the knowledge situation of communities, to encourage communities not to feel powerless within their own environment, but to feel that they can help the environment around them to sustain itself and in the process sustain them. I think this is the biggest message of the Green Belt Movement, empowering local communities so that they do not wait for the local authorities, wait for the government, wait for development agencies, but to encourage people to take action, no matter how small that action may be, including a small action like planting a tree and making sure it survives, or protecting a standing tree.
How does your environmental activism, Wangari Maathai, fit in with your political activism? You were imprisoned a number of times under the dictatorship, the regime of President Daniel Arap Moi. You demanded multi-party elections. You stopped a building complex from going up, skyscraper, the 60-story Kenya Times Media Trust business complex. Talk about each of these actions. Talk about nonviolent civil disobedience.
Well, actually, the message we have brought to the world and the message that actually encouraged the Nobel Peace Prize to give us the prize in the year 2004 was that we were able to show the linkage between the way we manage our resources, whether we manage them sustainably or in an unsustainable way. Also, the way we govern ourselves, whether we respect human rights of each other, whether we respect the rule of law, and whether we promote justice, fairness, and equity. these issues are very interrelated. Because if we do not manage our resources responsibly and accountably, it means we allow corruption, we allow a few individuals to benefit from these resources, to enrich themselves, and at the expense of the majority of the people. And eventually, the majority of the people who are left behind, who are not included, who are excluded, become very poor. And they will eventually react. And their reaction will threaten our peace and security. And it is for this, it is with this understanding, for this reason, that I eventually, and the members of the Green Belt Movement, found ourselves not only planting trees, but also promoting respect for human rights, respect for the rule of law, demanding a clean and healthy environment, demanding that in cities especially, you need open, green spaces for the betterment of the quality of life. And so while the tree planting campaign itself was a very benign and a very apolitical activity, ensuring that governments respect the space, respect the human rights of everybody in the society, it became necessary for us to become engaged positively with good as such for good governance. And that meant that we have to resist violation of human rights, that we have to resist violation of our environmental rights, such as taking green open spaces and putting buildings there, such as deforesting our forest, when we know that in order for us to get clean drinking water, in order for us to continue enjoying fresh air, clean air, we need those forests, we need those trees. So preventing greedy, corrupt, irresponsible leaders from accessing these resources and privatizing them, it became necessary for us to join in the pro-democracy movement of Kenya. And for many people, the linkage between democracy, sustainable management of resources, equity, justice, fairness, and peace was not very clear. But I think that in the year 2004, very much basing the decision on our work in Kenya, the Norwegian Nobel Committee saw the linkage as brought about together by our work. And so they gave the prize, and in the process challenged the world to see the connection, to see the linkage of governance, sustainable management of resources, equity, and peace. And that holistic approach was extremely important, a very strong idea that we had brought to the fore and which the Norwegian Nobel Committee wanted the world to embrace. And in fact, it's the message that we are trying to pass to the world, to encourage the world, whether it is at the local level or regional level or even at the global level, to encourage the world that these three are very linked and they are very basic principles for the stability and the peace and security of any nation.
Wangari Maathai, were you surprised when you won the Nobel Peace Prize? Where were you?
Well, when I was called by the chairman of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, I was actually on my way to my constituency. It was a Friday, and I usually spend weekends in my constituency. And I was very surprised, partly because, as we all know, it was the first time that the Norwegian Nobel Committee focused on the environment. In the past, it had focused on other issues. In the very beginning, it focused on people who went to the battlefield and collected bodies of the dead and the wounded and took care of them or buried the bodies with respect that deserves a human being. Later on, they focused on people who separated warring countries, warring factions, and brought them to the negotiating table to agree to stop fighting and to stop killing each other. Much later, they started focusing on people who focused on human rights, recognized the fact that if you have states or governments not respecting the rule of law, respecting human rights, it is very easy for us not to have security or peace. And so people like Martin Luther King, people like Mandela, were respected for this great work. And then in the year 2004, the committee decided that the time had come for the environment. And so it was the first time. So everybody was surprised. And I remember the very first questions were, what is the connection between trees and peace? And it has given me a great and wonderful forum to be able to show that indeed there is a link between the environment, which is symbolized by here by the tree, and the way we govern ourselves, and the way we manage the resources, and the way we share these resources. This is a very new message that the world needs to embrace, because when we have a critical mass of people and governments who understand this, then we shall deliberately and consciously work for these three to be consciously cultivated so as to promote, indirectly promote the peace by preempting the causes of conflict.
Wangari Maathai, your thoughts on the war in Iraq?
Well, I think that all of us are very saddened by the war in Iraq, because we did not think that it would last this long and that we would lose as many people as we have lost. Obviously, our sympathies go to the soldiers who are losing their lives every day and to the many civilians in Iraq who are losing their lives every day. And we certainly pray that sooner than later, this war will come to an end and that our governments, wherever they are, will find other ways of resolving conflicts in the world besides going to war. And in Africa in particular, I know we have many wars. We have a war in Darfur. We have wars in many other countries like the Congo, in West Africa, in Somalia right now. We are still having these wars. And these wars, when you look at all of them, you realize that they are all about resources. It's the question of who is going to control the resources in this country, who is going to be included, who is going to be excluded, who is going to be in charge of these resources. I think that if we would get the message that the Norwegian Nobel Committee gave us in the year 2004, we would sit back and rethink again. Isn't there another way of managing these resources, of sharing these resources, of being more inclusive, of allowing everybody to play a part, to benefit, so that we do not have to fight and kill each other, so that we can have the supreme control of these resources? For as long as we think that way, we will have wars. And Iraq, of course, is only one of the many wars going on in the world. We can stop these wars when we stop, when we start organizing ourselves differently, managing these resources differently, governing ourselves differently, and listening to the voices of citizens. I know that even as we went to war in Iraq, many people in this country and in many other parts of the world pleaded for patience, for waiting, for discussion, for dialogue. We lost, but we must continue to urge our governments to find better ways of managing the conflict over resources.
We'll be back with Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai in a minute.
Don't
Heaven by the Psychedelic Furs here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Nobel Peace Prize laureate Wangari Maathai, I asked her to talk about Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama's visit to Kenya, where his father was born.
Well, of course, Kenya is very excited about his candidacy. And when he came to Kenya, he was very warmly received. People loved him. And we had a wonderful opportunity to with him to plant a tree at Freedom Corner, which for us was very significant because that corner symbolizes our campaign for the reintroduction of a multi-party democracy and greater democratic space in Kenya. And of course, we are hoping that he has a very good chance to win. We know that they are very wonderful candidates. As a woman, of course, we are also very excited about Hillary Clinton. So we are really kind of torn apart because we are, in a way, we have two very exciting candidates. One in one who is connected to our country, and the other who is, of course, a great inspiration for women. So we are looking forward very much to see how the two of them will feature. I wish there was a way that we could have the two of them, and that would be a very exciting combination in the White House.
What do you think is the most important qualities for a president of the United States, and how does that position affect your life, affect the life of the people of Kenya, of Africa?
Well, of course, because the United States of America is a superpower, continues to have great influence throughout the world. Its decisions, its values, its attitude towards the world is extremely important. And the decisions that are made in Washington affect the rest of the world. We in Africa have been very, very keen on the United Nations, the United States of America being sensitive to the issues of Africa. Especially, we have raised the issue of debt for many years. We have also raised the issue of the protection of our environment, and especially the protection of the Congo forest. I'm particularly keen on this forest because it's not only important to Africa, but also important to the world with respect to climate change. And I know that the United States government is interested in this forest, as well as in the Amazon and other forests in Southeast Asia. And I would wish, and especially with respect to climate change, that America would provide the leadership that is needed, and that she would not be the one falling behind, because her attitude towards climate change and towards what we can do to mitigate the impact, the negative impact of climate change, especially in Africa, is very important. I was very encouraged by the discussions in Germany recently, because I felt like the leadership in America was changing its position about climate change. And I know that the Chancellor of Germany has been very vocal in favor of taking the right actions against the negative impacts of climate change. So I really look forward to the United States continuing this engagement and providing the leadership that is necessary, because what she does influences the reaction of other governments in the world.
Wangari Maathai, you signed on to a letter signed by a number of women Nobel Peace Prize winners, condemning the Iraq oil law that the Iraqi parliament has yet to sign, though the Bush administration has been pressing them hard to do that. Also opposing the decision of the U.S. government to require the Iraqi government to pass the oil law as a condition of continued reconstruction. The letter ends by saying it is immoral and illegal to use war and invasion as mechanisms for robbing a people of their vital natural resources, signed by Shireen Abadi, Betty Williams, Mairead McGuire, Professor Jody Williams, and you, Professor Wangari Maathai. Can you elaborate on this?
I think that our position as peace laureates is that As I have explained, and this is particularly relevant to me as a person who connects peace, good governance, and the right management of resources, is that our advocacy has always been that for us to be able to enjoy peace, it is very important for us to recognize the rights of people to manage their resources, the rights of people to be given an opportunity to say what they would like to do with their resources, the principle of equity to be practiced, especially by those who have the power to say no, but who are moved or who are guided by the principle of fairness and justice. And it is in that context that we were appealing to the U.S. government to practice justice and fairness and to allow for inclusivity as they try to bring peace to that war-torn country, and to recognize that until people feel that they are included, people feel that they are not being excluded, where the people feel that their resources are being used for the benefit of their people, that they are not being stripped of their resources, that moving in that direction is a better way of seeking peace. Because as long as people feel like they're being exploited, that they're being denied access to their resources, then of course they will react. And sometimes they react in a way that threatens peace and security, not only where they are, but indeed in the whole world.
Wangari Maathai, you're used to taking on presidents, corporations, anyone that you feel is in the way of environmental justice and peace. Your thoughts on corporations like ExxonMobil, the wealthiest on Earth, that has poured millions into think tanks to deny that global warming really is caused by human beings. Your thoughts?
Well, I guess as a company that was benefiting from fossil fuels throughout the world, I guess they would feel like they need to protect their position. And of course, for most of us, we rely very heavily on those who are doing research and those who have the knowledge, particularly the scientists. And as long as the scientists were not fully convinced that global warming is being caused by human activities, there were those who listened to arguments that we did not have enough scientific data to convince us that indeed it is our own activities that is causing global warming. But I think that last March this year, when the scientists finally brought out their report and said that they were certain, up to 90% plus certain, that it is our activities that are causing global warming, that I think that it is unjustifiable for anybody to try to change that position, because the scientists don't have any interest. And it is over 2,000 scientists who were engaged for a very long period of time with the research and information that they were able to compile and show us that indeed the industrialization of countries using fossil fuels has indeed contributed to the release of greenhouse gases that are causing the global warming. So I hope that a company like Mobil, which has benefited so immensely from these resources from many parts of the world, that they will embrace the principle that the United Nations Environment Program advocates, which says polluter pays, that this company will invest, especially in countries where they have caused a lot of environmental degradation and misery to millions of people, so that they can repay in a little way by investing in rehabilitation of such environments, cleaning up of such environments, and improving the quality of life of people who have suffered because of the processes of extraction of these resources from the earth. And I hope that in future, they will not see the need to deny what scientists have said conclusively for the benefit of the whole world.
Finally, as you travel around this country, the United States, Wangari Maathai, what you feel is the most important message?
But I must say that every time I travel in this country of the U.S., I'm very encouraged, not only by the reaction of citizens, cities, mayors, states, governors, but also by the fact that this is a country that has a strong civil society, populations that are willing to get out there and do something about their environment. This morning, I had a wonderful experience here in Seattle, Washington. We went to a small ravine here with kids from local schools and with the mayor, the local mayor, and we were planting trees in a little groove where there were some big trees, but we were planting some small trees with the children. It is that kind of activity where the mayor, the local populations, and the children come together to do something that simple, but which demonstrates the dynamism, the commitment, and the energy of the people of the United States of America. And even before, when people would tell me that we need to do something about the fact that America had not yet signed the Kyoto Protocol, I used to say, I'm not too worried about the fact that the government has not signed the Kyoto Protocol. I'm much more encouraged by the activities of ordinary citizens in America, those who are changing their bulbs and using bulbs that are saving energy, those who are deciding not to drive a car unless they have to because they want to reduce the amount of fossil fuel and the amount of greenhouse gases that they dump in the atmosphere. Those who are making those small actions like those children this morning planting trees, that's what makes the difference. And you will remember that recently, the United Nations Environment Program in Nairobi and the International Center for Agroforestry, which is also based in Nairobi, and the Greenbelt Movement launched the Global Billion Tree Campaign, trying to encourage the whole world to plant trees. Now, it is not so much what the billion tree can do that was the important message. More important was the message of get involved. Don't just sit and complain. Get involved. Be part of the solution. And do the doables, like planting a tree in your own compound.
Wangari Maathai, Nobel Peace Prize winner. Her memoir is called Unbowed. She was in the United States from Kenya. And that does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Odokadu, Saran Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.